At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
This Labor Day at Lowe's, shop member-only doorbuster deals for a limited time. Save $50 on an Ego string trimmer, now $169. Plus, get 50% off select Holland pavers. Not a rewards member? Sign up for free today. But hurry, Labor Day doorbuster deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 9-1 while supplies last. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Chapter 5 of The Country Beyond. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Country Beyond by James Oliver Curwood. Chapter 5. It was in the third week after his hurt that Peter saw Nada. By that time he could easily follow Jolly Roger as far as the fording place, and there he would wait, sometimes hours at a stretch, while his comrade and master went over to Cragg's Ridge. But frequently Jolly Roger would not cross, but remained with Peter, and would lie on his back at the edge of the grassy knoll they had found, reading one of the little old-fashioned red books which Peter knew were very precious to him. Often he wondered what was between the faded red covers that was so interesting, and if he could have read, he would have seen such titles as Margaret of Anjou, History of Napoleon, History of Peter the Great, Caesar, Columbus the Discoverer, and so on through the 20 volumes which Jolly Roger had taken from a wilderness mail 2 years before, and which he now prized next to his life. This afternoon, as they lay in the sleepy quiet of June, Jolly Roger answered the questioning inquisitiveness in Peter's face and eyes. "You see, Pied-Bot, it was this way," he said, beginning a little apologetically. "I was dying for something to read, and I figured there'd be something in the mail. Newspapers, you know. So I stopped it, and tied up the driver, and found these. And I swear I didn't take anything else, that time. There's 20 of them, and they weigh 9 pounds. And in the last 2 years I've toted them 5,000 miles. I wouldn't trade them for my weight in gold, and I'm pretty heavy. I named you after one of them, Peter. I pretty near called you Christopher Columbus. And some day we've got to take these books to the man they were going to, Peter. I've promised myself that. It seems sort of like stealing the soul out of someone. I just borrowed them, that's all. And I've kept the address of the owner away up on the edge of the barrens. Some day we're going to make a special trip to take the books home." Peter, all at once, had become interested in something else, and following the direction of his pointed nose, Jolly Roger saw Nada standing quietly in the opposite side of the stream, looking at them. In a moment Peter knew her, and he was trembling in every muscle when Jolly Roger caught him up under his arm, and with a happy laugh plunged through the creek with him. For a good 5 minutes after that, Jolly Roger stood aside, watching Peter and Nada, and there was a glisten of dampness in the eyes when he saw the wet on Nada's cheeks, and the whimpering joy of Peter as he caressed her face and hands. 3 weeks had been a long time to Peter, but he could see no difference in the little mistress he worshipped. There were still the radiant curls to hide his nose in, the gentle hands, the sweet voice, the warm thrill of her body as she hugged him in her arms. He did not know that she had new shoes and a new dress, and that some of the color had gone from her red lips, and that her cheeks were paler, and that she could no longer hide the old haunted look in her eyes. But Jolly Roger saw the look, and the growing pallor, and had noted them for 2 weeks past. And later that afternoon, when Nada returned to Cragg's Ridge, and he recrossed the stream with Peter, there was a hard and terrible look in his eyes which Peter had caught there more and more frequently of late. And that evening, in the twilight of their cabin, Jolly Roger said, "It's coming soon, Peter. I'm expecting it. Something is happening which she won't tell us about. She is afraid for me. I know it. But I'm going to find out, soon. And then, Pied-Bot, I think we'll probably kill Jed Hawkins, and hit for the north." The gloom of foreboding that was in Jolly Roger's voice and words seemed to settle over the cabin for many days after that, and more than ever, Peter sensed the thrill and warning of that mysterious something which was impending. He was developing swiftly, in flesh and bone and instinct, and there began to possess him now the beginning of that subtle caution and shrewdness which were to mean so much to him later on. An instinct greater than reason, if it was not reason itself, told him that his master was constantly watching for something which did not come. And that same instinct, or reason, impinged upon him the fact that it was a thing to be guarded against. He did not go blindly into the mystery of things now. He circumvented them, and came up from behind. Craft and cunning replaced mere curiosity and puppyish egoism. He was quick to learn, and Jolly Roger's word became his law, so that only once or twice he was told a thing, and it became a part of his understanding. While the keen, shrewd brain of his Airedale father developed inside Peter's head, the flesh and blood development of his big, gentle, soft-footed Mackenzie Hound mother kept pace in his body. His legs and feet began to lose their grotesqueness. Flesh began to cover the knots in his tail. His head, bristling fiercely with wiry whiskers, seemed to pause for a space to give his lanky body a chance to catch up with it. And in spite of his big feet, so clumsy that a few weeks ago they had stumbled over everything in his way, he could now travel without making a sound. So it came to pass, after a time, that when Peter heard footsteps approaching the cabin, he made no effort to reveal himself until he knew it was Jolly Roger who was coming. And this was strangely in spite of the fact that in the 5 weeks since Nada had brought him from Cragg's Ridge, no one but Jolly Roger and Nada had set foot within sight of the shack. It was an inborn caution, growing stronger in him each day. There came one early evening when Peter made a discovery. He had returned with Jolly Roger from a fishing trip farther down the creek, and scarcely had he set nose to the little clearing about the cabin when he caught the presence of a strange scent. He investigated it swiftly, and found it all about the cabin, and very strong close up against the cabin door. There were no doubts in Peter's mind. A man had been there, and this man had gone around and around the cabin, and had opened the door, and had even gone inside, for Peter found the scent of him on the floor. He tried, in a way, to tell Jolly Roger. He bristled and whined and looked searchingly into the darkening edge of the forest. Jolly Roger quested him for a few moments, and when he failed to find marks in the ground, he began cleaning a fish for supper, and said, "Probably a wolverine, Pied-Bot. The rascal came to see what he could find while we were away." But Peter was not satisfied. He was restless all that night. Sounds which had been familiar now held a new significance for him. The next day he was filled with a quiet but brooding expectancy. He resented the intrusion of the strange footprints. It was, in his process of instinctive reasoning, an encroachment upon the property rights of his master, and he was, true to the law of his species, the guardian of those rights. The fourth evening after the stranger's visit to the cabin, Jolly Roger was later than usual in returning from Cragg's Ridge. Peter had been on a hunting adventure of his own, and came to the cabin at sunset. But he never came out of cover now without standing quietly for a few moments, getting the wind, and listening. And tonight, poking his head between some balsams 20 yards from the shack, he was treated to a sudden thrill. The cabin door was open. And standing close to this door, looking quietly and cautiously about, stood a stranger. He was not like Jed Hawkins, was Peter's first impression. He was tall, with a wide-brimmed hat, and wore boots with striped trousers tucked into them, and on his coat were bits of metal which caught the last gleams of the sun. Peter knew nothing of the Royal Northwest Mounted Police, but he sensed danger, and he remained very quiet, without moving a muscle of his head or body, while the stranger looked about, with a hand on his unbuttoned pistol holster. Not until he entered the cabin and closed the door after him did Peter move back into the deeper gloom of the forest. And then, silent as a fox, he skulked through cover to the foot trail, and down the trail to the ford, across which Jolly Roger would come from Cragg's Ridge. There was still half an hour of daylight when Jolly Roger arrived. Peter did not, as usual, run to the edge of the bank to meet him. He remained sitting stolidly on his haunches, with his ears flattened, and in his whole attitude no sign of gladness at his master's coming. With every instinct of caution developed to the highest degree within him, Jolly Roger was lightning quick to observe the significance of small things. He spoke to Peter, caressed him with his hand, and moved on along the foot trail toward the cabin. Peter fell in behind him moodily, and after a few moments stopped and squatted on his haunches again. Jolly Roger was puzzled.
"What is it, Peter?" he asked. "Are you afraid of that wolverine?"
Peter whined softly, but even as he whined his ears were flat and his eyes filled with a red light as they glared down the trail beyond the outlaw. Jolly Roger turned and went on until he disappeared around a twist in the path. There he stopped and peered back. Peter was not following him, but still sat where he had left him. A quicker breath came to Jolly Roger's lips, and he went back to Peter. For fully a minute he stood beside him, watching and listening, and not once did the reddish glare in Peter's eyes leave the direction of the cabin. Jolly Roger's eyes had grown very bright, and suddenly he dropped on his knees beside Peter, and spoke softly, close up to his flattened ear.
"You say it isn't a wolverine, Peter? Is that what you're trying to tell me?"
Peter's teeth clicked, and he whimpered, never taking his eyes from ahead. There was a cold light in Jolly Roger's eyes as he rose to his feet, and he turned swiftly and quietly into the edge of the forest, and in the gloom that was gathering there his hand carried the big automatic. Peter followed him now, and Jolly Roger swung in a wide circle so that they came up on that forest side of the cabin where there was no window. And here Jolly Roger knelt down beside Peter again and whispered to him,
"You stay here, Pied-Bot. Understand? You stay here."
He pressed him down gently with his hand so that Peter understood. Then, slinking low and swift as a cat, Jolly Roger ran to the end of the cabin where there was no window. With his head close to the ground, he peered out cautiously at the door. It was closed. Then he looked at the windows. To the west, the curtains were up, as he had left them. And to the east, a whimsical smile played at the corners of his mouth. Those curtains he had kept tightly drawn. One of them was down now, but the other was raised 2 inches, so that one hidden within the cabin could watch the approach from the trail. He drew back, and under his breath he chuckled. He recognized the sheer nerve of the thing, the clever handiwork of it. Someone was inside the cabin, and he was ready to stake his life. It was Cassidy, the Irish bloodhound of M Division. If anyone ferreted him out, way down here in the edge of civilization, he had gambled with himself that it would be Cassidy. And Cassidy had come. Cassidy, who had hung like a wolf to his trails for 3 years, who had chased him across the Barren Lands, who had followed him up the Mackenzie and back again, who had fought with him and starved with him and froze with him, yet had never brought him to prison. Deep down in his heart, Jolly Roger loved Cassidy. They had played, and were still playing, a thrilling game, and to win that game had become the life's ambition of each. And now Cassidy was in there, confident that at last he had his man, and waiting for him to step into the trap. To Jolly Roger, in the face of its possible tragedy, there was a deep-seated humor in the situation. Three times in the last year and a half had he turned the tables on Cassidy, leaving him floundering in the cleverly woven webs which the man-hunter had placed for his victim. This was the fourth time, and Cassidy would be tremendously upset. Praying that Peter would remain quiet, Jolly Roger took off his shoes. After that he made no more sound than a ferret as he crept to the door. An inch at a time he raised himself, until he was standing up, with his ear half an inch from the crack that ran lengthwise of the frame. Holding his breath, he listened. For an interminable time, it seemed to him, there was no sound from within. He guessed what Cassidy was doing, peering through that slit of window under the curtain. But he was not absolutely sure, and he knew the necessity of making no error with Cassidy in there gripping the butt of his gun. Suddenly he heard a movement. A man's steps, subdued and yet distinct, were moving from the window toward the door. Halfway they paused and turned to one of the windows looking westward. But it was evident the watcher was not expecting his game from that direction, for after a moment's silence he returned to the window through which he could see the trail. This time Jolly Roger was sure. Cassidy was again peering through the window, with his back toward him, and every muscle in the forest rover's body gathered for instant action. In another moment he had flung open the door, and the watcher at the window whirled about to find himself looking straight into the muzzle of Jolly Roger's gun. For several minutes after that last swift movement of Jolly Roger's, Peter lay where his master had left him, his eyes fairly popping from his head in his eagerness to see what was happening. He heard voices, and then the wild thrill of Jolly Roger's laughter, and restraining himself no longer, he trotted cautiously to the open door of the cabin. In a chair sat the stranger with the broad-rimmed hat and high boots, with his hands securely tied behind him. And Jolly Roger was hustling about, filling a shoulder pack in the last light of the day. "Cassidy, I ought to kill you," Jolly Roger was saying as he worked, an exultant chuckle in his voice. "You don't give me any peace. No matter where I go, you're sure to come, and I can't remember that I ever invited you. I ought to put you out of the way and plant flowers over you, now that I've got the chance. But I'm too chicken-hearted. Besides, I like you. By the time you get tired of chasing me, you should be a pretty good man-hunter. But just now you lack finesse, Cassidy. You lack finesse." And Jolly Roger's chuckle broke into another laugh. Cassidy heaved out a grunt. "It's luck, just damned luck," he growled. "If it is, I hope it keeps up," said Jolly Roger. "Now, look here, Cassidy, let's make a man's bet of it. If you don't get me next time, if you fail, and I turn the trick on you once more, will you quit?" Cassidy's eyes gleamed in the thickening dusk. "If I don't get you next time, I'll hand in my resignation." The laughter went out of Jolly Roger's voice. "I believe you, Cassidy. You've played square, always. And now, if I free your hands, will you swear to give me a 2 hour start before you leave this cabin?" "I'll give you the start," said Cassidy. His lean face was growing indistinct in the gloom. Jolly Roger came up behind him. There was a slash of a knife, then he picked up his shoulder pack. At the door, he paused. "Look at your watch when I'm gone, Cassidy, and be sure you make it a full 2 hours."
"I'll make it 2 hours and 5 minutes," said Cassidy. "Hittin' north, are you, Jolly Roger?"
"I'm hittin' bushward," replied the outlaw. "I'm goin' where it's plenty thick and hard to travel, Cassidy. Goodbye."
He was gone. He hit straight north, making noise as he went. But once in the timber, he swung southward and plunged through the creek with Peter under his arm. Not until they had traveled a good half mile over the plain did Jolly Roger speak. Then he said, speaking directly at Peter,
"Cassidy thinks I'll sure hit for the north country again, Pied-Bot, but we're fooling him. I've sort of planned on something like this happening, and right now we're hitting for the tail end of Cragg's Ridge where there's a mess of rock that the devil himself can hardly get into. We've got to do it, boy. We can't leave the girl just now. We can't leave her."
Jolly Roger's voice choked. Then he paused for a moment and bent over to put his hand on Peter.
"If it hadn't been for you, Peter, Cassidy would have got me, for sure. And I'm wondering, Peter, I'm wondering, why did God forget to give a dog speech?"
Peter whined in answer, and through the darkness of the night they went on together. End of chapter 5. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 6 of The Country Beyond. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Country Beyond by James Oliver Curwood. Chapter 6. A frosty mist dulled the light of the stars, but this cleared away as Jolly Roger and Peter crossed the plain between the creek and Cragg's Ridge. They did not hurry, for McKay had faith in Cassidy's word. He knew the red-headed man-hunter would not break his promise. He would wait the full 2 hours in Indian Tom's cabin, and another 5 minutes after that. In Jolly Roger, as the minutes passed, exultation at his achievement died away, and there filled him again the old loneliness, the loneliness which called out against the fate which had made of Cassidy an enemy instead of a friend. And yet, what an enemy! He reached down and touched Peter's bushy head with his hand. "Why didn't the law give another man the assignment to run us down?" he protested. "Someone we could have hated, and who would have hated us. Why did they send Cassidy, the fairest and squarest man that ever wore red? We can't do him a dirty turn. We can't hurt him, Pied-Bot, even at the worst. And if ever he takes us into headquarters and looks at us through the bars, I feel it's going to be like a knife in his heart. But he'll do it, Peter, if he can. It's his job. And he's honest. We've got to say that of Cassidy." The ridge loomed up at the edge of the level plain, and for a few moments Jolly Roger paused while he looked off through the eastward gloom. A mile in that direction, beyond the cleft that ran like a great furrow through the ridge, was Jed Hawkins' cabin, still and dark under the faint glow of the stars. And in that cabin was Nada. He felt that she was sitting at her little window, looking out into the night, thinking of him, and a great desire gripped at his heart, tugging him in its direction. but he turned toward the west. "We can't let her know what has happened, boy," he said, feeling the urge of caution. "For a little while we must let her think we have left the country. If Cassidy sees her and talks with her, something in those blue flower eyes of hers might give us away if she knew we were hiding up among the rocks of the stew kettle. But I'm hoping God A'mighty won't let her see Cassidy, and I'm thinking he won't, Pied-Bot, because I've got a pretty good hunch he wants us to settle with Jed Hawkins before we go." It was a habit of his years of aloneness, this talking to a creature that could make no answer. But even in the darkness he sensed the understanding of Peter. Rocks grew thicker and heavier under their feet, and they went more slowly and occasionally stumbled in the gloom. But after a fashion they knew their way even in darkness. More than once Peter had wondered why his master had so carefully explored this useless mass of upheaved rock at the end of Cragg's Ridge. They had never seen an animal or a blade of grass in all its gray, sun-blasted sterility. It was like a hostile thing, overhung with a half-dead, slow-beating something that was like the dying pulse of an evil thing. And now darkness added to its mystery and its unfriendliness, as Peter nosed close at his master's heels. Up and up they picked their way, over and between ragged upheavals of rock, twisting into this broken path and that, feeling their way, partly sensing it, and always ascending toward the stars. Roger McKay did not speak again to Peter. Each time he came out where the sky was clear, he looked toward the solitary dark pinnacle, far up and ahead, strangely resembling a giant tombstone in the star-glow that was their guide. And after many minutes of strange climbing, in which it seemed to Jolly Roger the nail-heads in the soles of his boots made weirdly loud noises on the rocks, they came near to the top. There they stopped, and in a deeply shadowed place where there was a carpet of soft sand, with walls of rock close on either side, Jolly Roger spread out his blankets. Then he went out from the black shadow so that a million stars seemed not far away over their heads. Here he sat down and began to smoke, thinking of what tomorrow would hold for him, and of the many days destined to follow that tomorrow. Nowhere in the world was there to be, for him, the peace of an absolute certainty. Not until he felt the cold steel of iron bars with his two hands, and the fatal game had been played to the end. There was no corrosive bitterness of the vengeful in Jolly Roger's heart. For that reason, even his enemies, the police, had fallen into the habit of using the nickname which the wilderness people had given him. He did not hate these police. Curiously, he loved them. Their type was to him the living flesh and blood of the finest manhood since the Crusaders. And he did not hate the law. At times the law, as personified in all of its unswerving majesty, amused him. It was so terribly serious over such trivial things, like himself, for instance. It could not seem to sleep or rest until a man was hanged or snugly put behind hard steel, no matter how well that man loved his humankind and the world. And Jolly Roger loved both. In his heart he believed he had not committed a crime by achieving justice where otherwise there would have been no justice. Yet outwardly he cursed himself for a lawbreaker. And he loved life. He loved the stars silently glowing down at him tonight. He loved even the gray, lifeless rock, which recalled to his imaginative genius the terrific and interesting life that had once existed. He loved the ghostly majesty of the grave-like pinnacle that rose above him, and beyond that he loved all the world. But most of all, more than his own life or all that a thousand lives might hold for him, he loved the violet-eyed girl who had come into his life from the desolation and unhappiness of Jed Hawkins' cabin. Forgetting the law, forgetting all but her, he went at last into the dungeon-like gloom between the rocks, and after Peter had wallowed himself abed in the carpet of sand, they fell asleep. They awoke with the dawn, but for 3 days thereafter they went forth only at night, and for 3 days did not show themselves above the barricade of rocks. The stew kettle was what Jolly Roger had called it, and when the sun was straight above, or descending with the last half of the day, the name fitted. It was a hot place, so hot that at a distance its piled-up masses of white rock seemed to simmer and broil in the blazing heat of the July sun. Neither man nor beast would look into the heart of it, Jolly Roger had assured Peter, unless the one was half-witted and the other a fool. Looking at it from the meadowy green plain that lay between the ridge and the forest, their temporary retreat was anything but a temptation to the eye. Something had happened there a few thousand centuries before, and in a moment of evident spleen and vexation, the earth had vomited up that pile of rock debris, and Jolly Roger good-humoredly told himself and Peter that it was an act of providence especially intended for them, though planned and erupted some years before they were born. The third afternoon of their hiding, Jolly Roger decided upon action. This afternoon, all of the caloric guns of an unclouded sun had seemed to concentrate themselves on the gigantic rock pile. Though it was now almost sunset, a swirling and dizzying incandescence still hovered about it. The huge masses of stone were like baked things to the touch of hand and foot, and one breathed a smoldering air in between their gray and white walls. Thus forbidding looked the stew kettle when viewed from the plain, but from the topmost crag of the mass, which rose 100 feet high at the end of the ridge, one might find his reward for a blistering climb. On all sides, a paradise of green and yellow and gold stretched the vast wilderness, studded with shimmering lakes that gleamed here and there from out of their rich dark frames of spruce and cedar and balsam. And halfway between the edge of the plain and this highest pinnacle of rock, utterly hidden from the eyes of both man and beast, nestled the hiding place which Jolly Roger and Peter had found. It was a cool and cavernous spot, in spite of the Sahara-like heat of the great pile. In the very heart of it, two gigantic masses of rock had put their shoulders together, like Gog and Magog, so that under their 10,000 tons of weight was a crypt-like tunnel as high as a man's head, into which the light and the glare of the sun never came. Peter, now that he had grown accustomed to the deadness of it, liked this change from Indian Tom's cabin. He liked his wallow of soft sand during the day, and he liked still more the aloneness and the aloofness of their ramparted stronghold when the cool of evening came. He did not, of course, understand just what their escape from Cassidy had meant, but instinct was shrewdly at work within him, and no wolf could have guarded the place more carefully than he. And he had all creation in mind when he guarded the rock pile. All but Nada. Many times he whimpered for her, just as the great call for her was in Jolly Roger's own heart. And on this third afternoon, as the hot July sun dipped halfway to the western forests, both Peter and his master were looking yearningly, and with the same thought, toward the east, where over the backbone of Cragg's Ridge, Jed Hawkins' cabin lay. "We'll let her know tonight," Roger McKay said at last, with something very slow and deliberate in his voice. "We'll take the chance and let her know." Peter's bristling Airedale whiskers, standing out like a bunch of broom splints about his face, quivered sympathetically, and he thumped his tail in the sand. He was an artful hypocrite, was Peter, because he always looked as if he understood, whether he did or not. And Jolly Roger, staring at the gray rock-backs outside their tunnel door, went on.
"We must play square with her, Pied-Bot, and it's a crime worse than murder not to let her know the truth. If she wasn't a kid, Peter... But she's that, just a kid. The sweetest, purest thing God Almighty ever made. And it isn't fair to live this lie any longer, no matter how we love her. And we do love her, Peter."
Peter lay very quiet, watching the strange gray look that had settled in Jolly Roger's face.
"I've got to tell her that I'm a damned highwayman," he added, in a moment. "And she won't understand, Peter. She can't. But I'm going to do it. I'm going to tell her, today. And then I think we'll be hitting north pretty soon, Pied-Bot. And if it wasn't for Jed Hawkins..."
He rose up out of the sand, his hands clenched.
"We ought to kill Jed Hawkins before we go. It would be safer for her," he finished.
He went out, forgetting Peter, and climbed a rock-splintered path until he stood on the knob of a mighty boulder, looking off into the northern wilderness. Off there, 100, 500, 1,000 miles, was home. It was all his home, from Hudson's Bay to the Rockies, from the height of land to the Arctic plains, and in it he had lived the thrill of life according to his own peculiar code. He knew that he had loved life as few had ever loved it. He had worshipped the sun and the moon and the stars. The world had been a glorious place in which to live, in spite of its ceaseless peril for him. But there was nothing of cheer left in his heart now as he stood in the blaze of the setting sun. Paradise had come to him for a little while, and because of it he had lived a lie. He had not told Jed Hawkins' foster girl that he was an outlaw, and that he had come to the edge of civilization because he thought it was the last place the Royal Monad would look for him. When he went to her this evening, it would probably be for the last time. He would tell her the truth. He would tell her the police were after him from one end of the Canadian Northland to the other. And that same night, with Peter, he would hit the trail for the Barren Lands, 1,000 miles away. He was sure of himself now, sure, even as the dark wall of the forest across the plain faded out and gave place to a pale, girlish face with eyes blue as flowers and brown curls filled with the luster of the sun, a face that had taken the place of mother, sister, and God deep down in his soul. Yes, he was sure of himself, even with that face rising to give battle to his last great test of honor. He was an outlaw, and the police wanted him. But Peter was troubled by the grimness that settled in his master's face. They waited for dusk, and when deep shadows had gathered in the valley, McKay led the way out of the rock pile. An hour later they came cautiously through the darkness that lay between the broken shoulders of Cragg's Ridge. There was a light in the cabin, but Nada's window was dark. Peter crouched down under the warning pressure of McKay's hand.
"I'll go on alone," he said. "You stay here."
It seemed a long time that he waited in the darkness. He could not hear the low tap, tap, tap of his master's fingers against the glass of Nada's darkened window. And Jolly Roger, in response to that signal tapping, heard nothing from within, except a monotone of voice that came from the outer room. For half an hour he waited, repeating the signals at intervals. At last a door opened, and Nada stood silhouetted against the light of the room beyond. McKay tapped again, very lightly, and the door closed quickly behind the girl. In a moment she was at the window, which was raised a little from the bottom.
"Mr. Roger," she whispered, "is it you?"
"Yes," he said, finding a little hand in the darkness. "It's me."
The hand was cold, and its fingers clung tightly to his, as if the girl was frightened. Peter, restless with waiting, had come up quietly in the dark, and he heard the low, trembling whisper of Nada's voice at the window. There was something in the note of it, and in the caution of Jolly Roger's reply, that held him stiff and attentive, his ears wide open for approaching sound. For several minutes he stood thus, and then the whispering voices at the window ceased, and he heard his master retreating very quietly through the night. When Jolly Roger spoke to him, back under the broken shoulder of the ridge, he did not know that Peter had stood near the window. McKay stood looking back at the pale glow of light in the cabin.
"Something happened there tonight. Something she wouldn't tell me about," he said, speaking half to Peter and half to himself. "I could feel it. I wish I could have seen her face."
He set out over the plain, and then, as if remembering that he must explain the matter to Peter, he said,
"She can't get out tonight, Pied-Bot, but she'll come to us in the jackpines tomorrow afternoon. We'll have to wait."
He tried to say the thing cheerfully, but between this night and tomorrow afternoon seemed an interminable time, now that he was determined to make a clean breast of his affairs to Nada and leave the country. Most of that night he walked in the coolness of the moonlit plain, and for a long time he sat amid the flower-scented shadows of the trysting place in the heart of the jackpine clump, where Nada had a hidden place all her own. It was here that Peter discovered something which Jolly Roger could not see in the deep shadows, a bundle warm and soft and sweet with the presence of Nada herself. It was hidden under a clump of young banksians, very carefully hidden, and tucked about with grass and evergreen boughs. When McKay left the jackpines, he wondered why it was that Peter showed no inclination to follow him until he was urged. They did not return to the stew kettle until dawn, and most of that day Jolly Roger spent in sleep between the two big rocks. It was late afternoon when they made their last meal. In this farewell hour McKay climbed up close to the pinnacle, where he smoked his pipe and measured the shadows of the declining sun, until it was time to leave for the jackpines. Retracing his steps to the hiding-place under Gog and Magog, he looked for Peter. But Peter's sand-wallow was empty, and Peter was gone. End of Chapter 6. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 7 of The Country Beyond. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Country Beyond by James Oliver Curwood. Chapter 7. Peter was on his way to the mystery of the bundle he had found in the jackpines. At the foot of the ridge, where the green plain fought with the blighting edge of the stew kettle, he stood for many minutes before he started eastward. With keen eyes gleaming behind his mop of scraggly face-bristles, he critically surveyed both land and air, and then, with the slight limp in his gait which would always remain as a mark of Jed Hawkins' brutality, he trotted deliberately in the direction of the whiskey-runner's cabin home. A bitter memory of Jed Hawkins flattened his ears when he came near the rock-cluttered coulee in which he had fought for Nada and had suffered his broken bones. And today, even as he obeyed the instinctive caution to stop and listen, Jed Hawkins himself came out of the mouth of the coulee, bearing a brown jug in one hand and a thick cudgel in the other. His one wicked eye gleamed in the waning sun. His lean and scraggly face was alight with a sinister exultation as he paused for a moment close to the rock behind which Peter was hidden, and Peter's fangs lay bare, and his body trembled while the man stood there. Then he moved on, and Peter did not stir, but waited until the jug and the cudgel and the man were out of sight. Low under his breath he was snarling when he went on. Hatred, for a moment, had flamed hot in his soul. Then he turned and buried himself in a clump of balsams that reached out into the plain, and a few moments later came to the edge of a tiny meadow in the heart of them, where a warbler was bursting its throat in evening song. Around the edge of the meadow Peter circled, his feet deep in buttercups and red fireflowers, and crushing softly ripe strawberries that grew in scarlet profusion in the open, until he came to a screen of young jackpines, and through these he quietly and apologetically nosed his way. Then he stood wagging his tail, with Nada sitting on the grass half a dozen steps from him, wiping the strawberry stain from her fingertips. And the stain was on her red lips, and a bit of it against the flush of her cheek, as she gave a little cry of gladness and greeting to Peter. Her eyes flashed beyond him, and every drop of blood in her slim, beautiful little body seemed to be throbbing with an excitement new to Peter as she looked for Jolly Roger. Peter went to her and dropped down, with his head in her lap, and looking up through his bushy eyebrows, he saw a livid bruise just under the ripples of her brown hair, where there had been no mark yesterday or the day before. Nada's hands drew him closer, until he was half in her lap, and she bent her face down to him, so that her thick, shining hair fell all about him. Peter loved her hair almost as much as Jolly Roger loved it, and he closed his eyes and drew a deep breath of content, as the smothering sweetness of it shut out the sunlight from him. "Peter," she whispered, "I'm almost scared to have him come today. I've promised him. You remember, I promised to tell him if Jed Hawkins struck me again. And he has. He made that mark, and if Jolly Roger knows it, he'll kill him. I've got to lie. Lie!" Peter wriggled, to show his interest, and his hard tail thumped the ground. For a space Nada said nothing more, and he could hear and feel the beating of her heart close down against him. Then she raised her head and looked in the direction from which she would first hear Jolly Roger as he came through the young jackpines. Peter, with his eyes half closed in a vast contentment, did not see or sense the change in her today, that her blue eyes were brighter, her cheeks flushed, and in her body a strange and subdued throbbing that had never been there before. Not even to Peter did she whisper her secret, but waited and listened for Jolly Roger, and when at last she heard him and he came through the screen of jackpines, the color in her cheeks was like the stain of strawberries crimsoning her fingertips. In an instant, looking down upon her, Jolly Roger saw what Peter had not discovered, and he stopped in his tracks, his heart thumping like a hammer inside him. Never, even in his dreams, had the girl looked lovelier than she did now, and never had her eyes met his eyes as they met them today, and never had her red lips said as much to him without uttering a word. In the same instant he saw the livid bruise, half hidden under her hair, and then he saw a big bundle behind her, partly screened by a dwarfed banksian. After that his eyes went back to the bruise.
"Jed Hawkins didn't do it,"
said Nada, knowing what was in his mind.
"It was Jed's woman, and you can't kill her," she added a little defiantly.
Jolly Roger caught the choking throb in her throat, and he knew she was lying. But Nada thrust Peter from her lap and stood up, and she seemed taller and more like a woman than ever before in her life as she faced Jolly Roger there in the tiny open, with violets and buttercups and red strawberries in the soft grass under their feet. And behind them, and very near, a rival to the warbler in the meadow began singing. But Nada did not hear. The color had rushed hot into her cheeks at first, but now it was fading out as swiftly, and her hands trembled, clasped in front of her. But the blue in her eyes was as steady as the blue in the sky as she looked at Jolly Roger.
"I'm not going back to Jed Hawkins any more, Mr. Roger," she said.
A soft breath of wind lifted the tress of hair from her forehead, revealing more clearly the mark of Jed Hawkins' brutality, and Nada saw gathering in Jolly Roger's eyes that cold, steely glitter which always frightened her when it came. His hands clenched, and when she reached out and touched his arm, the flesh of it was as hard as white birch. Even in her fear, there was glory in the thought that, at a word from her, he would kill the man who had struck her. Her fingers crept up his arm, timidly, and the blue in her eyes darkened, and there was a pleading tremble in the curve of her lips as she looked straight at him. "I'm not going back," she repeated. Jolly Roger, looking beyond her, saw the significance of the bundle. His eyes met her steady gaze again, and his heart seemed to swell in his chest and choke him. He tried to let his tense muscles relax. He tried to smile. He struggled to bring up the courage which would make possible the confession he had to make. And Peter, sitting on his haunches in a patch of violets, watched them both, wondering what was going to happen between these two. "Where are you going?" Jolly Roger asked. Nada's fingers had crept almost to his shoulder. They were twisting at his flannel shirt nervously, but not for the tenth part of a second did she drop her eyes, and that strange, wonderful something which he saw looking at him so clearly out of her soul brought the truth to Jolly Roger before she had spoken. "I'm going with you and Peter." The low cry that came from Jolly Roger was almost a sob as he stepped back from her. He looked away from her, at Peter. But her pale face, her parted red lips, her wide-open, wonderful eyes, her radiant hair stirred by the wind, came between them. She was no longer the little girl, past 17 going on 18. To Jolly Roger, she was all that the world held of glorious womanhood. "But you can't!" he cried desperately. "I've come to tell you things, Nada. I'm not fit. I'm not what you think I am. I've been living a lie." He hesitated, and then lashed himself on to the truth. "You'll hate me when I tell you, Nada. You think Jed Hawkins is bad, but the law thinks I'm worse. The police want me. They've wanted me for years. That's why I came down here and hid over in Indian Tom's cabin, near where I first met you. I thought they wouldn't find me away down here, but they did. That's why Peter and I moved over to the big rock pile at the end of the ridge. I'm an outlaw. I've done a lot of bad things in the eyes of the law, and I'll probably die with a bullet in me or in jail. I'm sorry, but that don't help. I'd give my life to be able to tell you what's in my heart, but I can't. It wouldn't be square." He wondered why no change came into the steady blue of her eyes as he went on with the truth. The pallor was gone from her cheeks. Her lips seemed redder, and what he was saying did not seem to startle her or frighten her. "Don't you understand, Nada?" he cried. "I'm bad. The police want me. I'm a fugitive, always running away, always hiding. An outlaw." She nodded. "I know it, Mr. Roger," she said quietly. "I heard you tell Peter that a long time ago. And Mr. Cassidy was at our place the day after you and Peter ran away from Indian Tom's cabin, and I showed him the way to Father John's, and he told me a lot about you. And he told Father John a lot more. And it made me awful proud of you, Mr. Roger. And I want to go with you and Peter." "Proud?" gasped Jolly Roger. "Proud of me?" She nodded again. "Mr. Cassidy, the policeman, he used just the word you used a minute ago. He said you was square, even when you robbed other people. He said he had to get you in jail if he could, but he hoped he never would. He said he'd like to have a man like you for a brother. And Peter loves you. And I..." The color came into her white face. "I'm going with you and Peter," she finished. Something came to relieve the tenseness of the moment for Jolly Roger. Peter, nosing in a thick patch of bunch grass, put out a huge snowshoe rabbit, and the two crashed in a startling avalanche through the young jackpines, Peter's still puppyish voice yelling in a high staccato as he pursued. Jolly Roger turned from Nada and stared where they had gone. But he was seeing nothing. He knew the hour of his mightiest fight had come. In the reckless years of his adventuring, he had more than once faced death. He had starved. He had frozen. He had run the deadliest gauntlets of the elements, of beast, and of man. Yet was the strife in him now the greatest of all his life. His heart thumped. His brain was swirling in a vague and chaotic struggle for the mastery of things, and as he fought with himself, his unseeing eyes fixed on the spot where Peter and the snowshoe rabbit had disappeared, he heard Nada's voice behind him, saying again that she was going with him and Peter. In those seconds he felt himself giving way, and the determined action he had built up for himself began to crumble like sand. He had made his confession, and in spite of it, this young girl he worshipped, sweeter and purer than the flowers of the forest, was urging herself upon him. And his soul cried out for him to turn about, and open his arms to her, and gather her into them for as long as God saw fit to give him freedom and life. But still he fought against that mighty urge, dragging reason and right back fragment by fragment, while Nada stood behind him, her wide-open, childishly beautiful eyes beginning to comprehend the struggle that was disrupting the heart of this man who was an outlaw and her god among men. And when Jolly Roger turned, his face had aged to the grayness of stone, and his eyes were dull, and there was a terribly dead note in his voice.
"You can't go with us," he said. "You can't. It's wrong, all wrong. I couldn't take care of you in jail, and some day that's where I'll be."
More than once, when she had spoken of Jed Hawkins, he had seen the swift flash of lightning come into the violet of her eyes. And it came now, and her little hands grew tight at her sides, and bright spots burned in her cheeks.
"You won't," she cried. "I won't let you go to jail. I'll fight for you, if you'll let me go with you and Peter."
She came a step nearer.
"And if I stay here, Jed Hawkins is going to sell me to a tie cutter over on the railroad. That's what it is, selling me. I haven't told you before because I was afraid of what you'd do. But it's going to happen unless you let me go with you and Peter. Oh, Mr. Roger, Mr. Jolly Roger."
Her fingers crept up his arms. They reached his shoulders, and her blue eyes, and her red lips, and the woman soul in her girl body were so close to him he could feel their sweetness and thrill, and then he saw a slow gathering mist and tears.
"I'll go wherever you go," she was whispering, "and we'll hide where they won't ever find us. And I'll be happy, so happy, Mr. Roger. And if you won't take me, I want to die. Oh!"
She was crying, with her head on his breast and her slim, half-bare arms around his neck, and Jolly Roger listened like a miser to the choking words that came with her sobs. And where there had been tumult and indecision in his heart, there came suddenly the clearness of sunshine and joy, and with it the happiness of a new and mighty possession, as his arms closed about her, and he turned her face up, so that for the first time he kissed the soft red lips that for some inscrutable reason the God of all things had given into his keeping this day. And then, holding her close, with her arms still tighter about his neck, he cried softly,
"I'm going to take you, little girl. You're going with Peter and me, forever and ever. And we'll go tonight."
When Peter came back, just in the last sunset glow of the evening, he found his master alone in the bit of jackpine opening, and Nada was swiftly crossing the larger meadow that lay between them and the break in Cragg's Ridge, beyond which was Jed Hawkins' cabin. It was not the same Jolly Roger whom he had left half an hour before. It was not the man of the hiding-place in the rock-pile. Jolly Roger McKay, standing there in the last soft glow of the day, was no longer the fugitive and the outcast. He stood with silent lips, yet his soul was crying out its gratitude to all that God of life which breathed its sweetness of summer evening about him. He was the first possessor of the earth. In that hour, that moment, he would not have sold his place for all the happiness of all the remaining people in the world. He cried out loud, and Peter, squatted at his feet with his red tongue lolling out, listened to him.
"She is mine! Mine! Mine!" he was saying, and he repeated that word over and over until Peter quirked his ears and wondered what it meant. And then, seeing Peter, Jolly Roger laughed softly and bent over him with a look of awe and wonderment mingling with the happiness in his face. "She's mine! Ours!" he cried boyishly. "God A'mighty took a hand, Pied-Bot, and she's going with us. We're going tonight, when the moon comes up. And Peter, we're going straight to the missioner's, and he'll marry us, and then we'll hit for a place where no one in the world will ever find us. The law may want us, Pied-Bot, but God, this God all around, is good to us, and we'll try and pay him back. We will, Peter."
He straightened himself and faced the west. Then he picked up the bundle Nada had brought and dived through the jackpines with Peter at his heels. Swiftly they moved through the shadowing dusk of the plain and came at last to the stew kettle and to their hiding place under the shoulders of Gog and Magog. There was still a faint twilight in the tunnel, and in this twilight Jolly Roger McKay packed his possessions, and then, with fingers that trembled as if they were committing a sacrilege, he drew Nada's few treasures from her bundle and placed them tenderly with his own. And all the time Peter heard him saying things under his breath, so softly that it was like the whispered drone of song. In darkness they went down through the rocks to the plain, and half an hour later they came to the break in the ridge, and went through it, and stopped in the black shadow of a great rock, with Jed Hawkins' cabin half a rifle shot away. Here Nada was to come to them with the first rising of the moon. It was very still all about, and Peter sensed a significance in the silence, and lay very quietly, watching the light in the cabin and the shadowy form of his master. Also, he knew that somewhere in the distance a storm was gathering. The breath of it was in the air, though the sky was clear of cloud overhead, except for the haze of a gray and ghostly mist that lay between them and the yellow stars. Jolly Roger counted the seconds between then and moonrise. It seemed hours before the golden rim of it rose in the east. Shadows grew swiftly after that. Grotesque things took shape. The rock caps of the ridge began to light up like timid signal fires. Black spruce and balsam and cedar glistened as if bathed in enamel. And the moon came on, and mellow floods of light played in the valleys and plains, and danced over the forest tops, and in voiceless and soundless miracle called upon all living things to look upon the glory of God. In his soul, Jolly Roger McKay felt the urge and the call of that voiceless master power, and through his lips came an unconscious whisper of prayer, of gratitude. And he watched the light in Jed Hawkins' cabin, and strained his ears to hear a sound of footsteps coming through the moonlight. But there was no change. The light did not move. A door did not open or close. There was no sound, except the growing whisper of the wind, the call of a night bird, and the howl of the old gray wolf that always cried out to the moon from the tangled depths of Indian Tom's swamp. A thrill of nervousness swept through Jolly Roger. He waited half an hour, three quarters, an hour after the moon had risen. And Nada did not come. The nervousness grew in him, and he moved out into the moon glow, and slowly and watchfully followed the edge of the rock shadows until he came to the fringe of cedars and spruce behind the cabin. Peter, careful not to snap a twig under his paws, followed closely. They came to the cabin, and there, very distinctly, Jolly Roger McKay heard the low moaning of a voice. He edged his way to the window and looked in. Crouched beside a chair in the middle of the floor was Jed Hawkins' woman. She was moaning, and her thin body was rocking back and forth, and with her hands clasped at her bony breast, she was staring at the open door. With a shock, Jolly Roger saw that except for the strangely crying old woman, the cabin was empty. Sudden fear chilled his blood, a fear that scarcely took form before he was at the door and in the cabin. The woman's eyes were red and wild as she stared at him, and she stopped her moaning and her hands unclasped. Jolly Roger went nearer and bent over her and shivered at the half-mad terror he saw in her face. "Where is Nada?" he demanded. "Tell me, where is she?"
"Gone, gone, gone!"
crooned the woman, clutching her hands at her breast again.
"Jed has taken her! Taken her to Mooney's shack, over near the railroad! Oh, my God! I tried to keep her, but I couldn't! He dragged her away! And tonight he's selling her to Mooney, the devil, the black brute, the tie-cutter!"
She choked and began rocking herself back and forth, and the moaning came again from her thin lips. Fiercely McKay gripped her by the shoulder.
"Mooney shack, where?" he cried. "Quick, tell me!"
A thousand! He's given $1,000 to get her in the shack, alone!" she cried in a dull, sing-song voice. "The road out there leads straight to it, near the railroad. A mile, 2 miles. I tried to keep him from doing it, but I couldn't. I couldn't."
Jolly Roger heard no more. He was out of the door and running across the open with Peter racing close behind him. They struck the road, and Jolly Roger swung into it and continued to run until the breath was out of his lungs. And all that time, the things Nada had told him about Jed Hawkins and the tie-cutter were rushing madly through his brain. An hour or two ago, when the words had come from her lips in the jackpine thicket, he had believed that Nada was frightened, that a distorted fear possessed her, that such a thing as she had half confessed to him was too monstrous to happen. And now he cried out aloud, a groaning, terrible cry, as he went on. Hawkins and Nada had reached Mooney's shack long before this, a shack buried deep in the wilderness, a shack from which no cries could be heard. Peter, trotting behind, whined at what he heard in Jolly Roger McKay's panting voice. And the moon shone on them as they staggered and ran, and here and there dark clouds were racing past the face of it, and the slumberous whisper of storm grew nearer in the air. And then came the time when one of the dark clouds rode under the moon, and the two ran on in darkness. The cloud passed, and the moon flooded the road again with light, and suddenly Jolly Roger stopped in his tracks, and his heart almost broke in the strain of that moment. Ahead of them, staggering toward them, sobbing as she came, was Nada. Jolly Roger's blazing eyes saw everything in that vivid light of the moon. Her hair was tangled and twisted about her shoulders and over her breast. One arm was bare where the sleeve had been torn away, and her girlish breast gleamed white where her waist had been stripped half from her body. And then she saw Jolly Roger in the trail, with wide-open, reaching arms, and with a cry such as Peter had never heard come from her lips before, she ran into them, and held up her face to him in the yellow moonlight. In her eyes, great, tearless, burning pools, he saw the tragedy, and yet it was only that, and not horror, nor despair, not the other thing. His arms closed crushingly about her. Her slim body seemed to become a part of him. Her hot lips reached up and clung to his. And then,
"Did he get you to Mooney's shack?"
He felt her body stiffen against him.
"No," she panted. "I fought every inch. He dragged me and hit me and tore my clothes, but I fought. And up there, in the trail, he turned his back for a moment when he thought I was done, and I hit him with a club. And he's there now, on his back."
She did not finish. Jolly Roger thrust her out from him, arm's length. A cloud under the moon hid his face, but his voice was low and terrible.
"Nada, go to the missioners as fast as you can," he said, fighting to speak coolly. "Take Peter and go. You will make it before the storm breaks. I am going back to have a few words with Jed Hawkins, alone. Then I will join you, and the missioner will marry us."
The cloud was gone, and he saw joy and radiance in her face. Fear had disappeared. Her eyes were luminous with the golden glow of the night. Her red lips were parted, entreating him with the lure of their purity and love, and for a moment he held her close in his arms again, kissing her as he might have kissed an angel, while her little hand stroked his face, and she laughed softly and strangely in her happiness, the wonder of a woman's soul rising swiftly out of the sweetness of her girlhood. And then Jolly Roger set her firmly in the direction she was to go.
"Hurry, little girl," he said. "Hurry, before the storm breaks."
She went, calling Peter softly, and Jolly Roger strode down the trail, not once looking back, and bent only upon the vengeance he would this night wreak upon the two lowest brutes in creation. Never before had he felt the desire to kill. But he felt that desire now. Before the night was much older, he would do unto Hawkins and Mooney as Hawkins had done unto Peter. He would leave them alive, but broken and crippled and forever punished. And then he stumbled over something in another darkening of the moon. He stopped, and the light came again, and he looked down into the upturned face of Jed Hawkins. It was a distorted and twisted face, and its one eye was closed. The body did not move. And close to the head was the club which Nada had used. Jolly Roger laughed grimly. Fate was kind to him in making a half of his work so easy. But he wanted Hawkins to rouse himself first. Roughly, he stirred him with the toe of his boot.
"Wake up, you fiend!" he said. "I'm going to break your bones, your arms, your legs, just as you broke Peter and that poor old woman back in the cabin. Wake up!"
Jed Hawkins made no stir. He was strangely limp. For many seconds, Jolly Roger stood looking down at him, his eyes growing wider, more staring. Darkness came again. It was an inky blackness this time, like a blotter over the world. Low thunder came out of the west. The treetops whispered in a frightened sort of way. And Jolly Roger could hear his heart beating. He dropped upon his knees, and his hands moved over Jed Hawkins. For a space, not even Peter could have heard his movement or his breath. In the ebon darkness, he rose to his feet, and the night, lifelessly still for a moment, heard the one choking word that came from his lips.
"Dead!"
And there he stood, the heat of his rage changing to an icy chill, his heart dragging within him like a chunk of lead, his breath choking in his throat. Jed Hawkins was dead. He was growing stiff there in the black trail. He had ceased to breathe. He had ceased to be a part of life. and the wind, rising a little with the coming of storm, seemed to whisper and chortle over the horrible thing, and the lone wolf in Indian Tom's swamp howled weirdly, as if he smelled death. Jolly Roger McKay's fingernails dug into the flesh of his palms. If he had killed the human viper at his feet, if his own hands had meted out his punishment, he would not have felt the clammy terror that wrapped itself about him in the darkness. But he had come too late. It was Nada who had killed Jed Hawkins. Nada, with her woman's soul just born in all its glory, had taken the life of her foster father. And Canadian law knew no excuse for killing. The chill crept to his fingertips, and unconsciously, in a childish sort of way, he sobbed between his clenched teeth. The thunder was rolling nearer, and it was like a threatening voice, a deep-toned booming of a thing inevitable and terrible. He felt the air shivering about him, and suddenly something moved softly against his foot, and he heard a questioning whine. It was Peter, come back to him in this hour when he needed a living thing to give him courage. With a groan, he dropped on his knees again and clutched his hands about Peter.
"My God!" he breathed huskily. "Peter, she's killed him, and she mustn't know. We mustn't let anyone know."
And there he stopped, and Peter felt him growing rigid as stone, and for many moments Jolly Roger's body seemed as lifeless as that of the man who lay with upturned face in the trail. Then he fumbled in a pocket and found a pencil and an old envelope. And on the envelope, with the darkness so thick he could not see his hand, he scribbled, "I killed Jed Hawkins." And after that he signed his name firmly and fully, Jolly Roger McKay. Then he tucked the envelope under Jed Hawkins' body, where the rain could not get at it. And after that, to make the evidence complete, he covered the dead man's face with his coat.
"We've got to do it, Peter," he said.
And there was a new note in his voice as he stood up on his feet again. "We've got to do it, for her.
We'll tell her we caught Jed Hawkins in the trail and killed him."
Caution, cleverness, his old mental skill returned to him. He dragged the bootlegger's body to a new spot, turned it face down, threw the club away, and kicked up the earth with his boots to give signs of a struggle. The note in his voice was triumph. Triumph, in spite of its heartbreak, as he turned back over the trail after he had finished and spoke to Peter.
"We may have done some things we oughtn't do, Pied Bot," he said, "but tonight I sort of think we tried to make restitution. And if they hang us, which they probably will sometime, I sort of think it'll make us happy to know we've done it for her. Eh, Pied Bot?"
And the moon sailed out for a space and shone on the dead whiteness of Jolly Roger's face. And on the lips of that face was a strange, cold smile, a smile of mastery, of exultation, and the eyes were looking straight ahead, the eyes of a man who had made his sacrifice for a thing more precious to him than his God. Only now and then did the moon gleam through the slow-moving masses of black cloud when he came to the edge of the Indian settlement clearing 3 miles away, where stood the cabin of the missioner. The storm had not broken, but seemed holding back its forces for one mighty onslaught upon the world. The thunder was repressed, and the lightning held in leash, with escaping flashes of it occasionally betraying the impending ambuscades of the sky. The clearing itself was a blot of Stygian darkness, with a yellow patch of light in the center of it, the window of the missioner's cabin. And Jolly Roger stood looking at it for a space, as a carven thing of rock might have stared. His heart was dead, his soul crushed, his dream broken. There remained only his brain, his mind made up, his worship for the girl, a love that had changed from a thing of joy to a fire of agony within him. Straight ahead he looked, knowing there was only one thing for him to do, and only one. There was no alternative, no hope, no change of fortune that even the power of God might bring about. What lay ahead of him was inevitable. After all, there is something unspeakable in the might and glory of dying for one's country, or for a great love, and Jolly Roger McKay felt that strength as he strode through the blackness and knocked at the door, and went in to face Nada and the little old gray-haired missioner in the lamp glow. Swift as one of the flashes of lightning in the sky, the anxiety and fear had gone out of Nada's face, and in an instant it was flooded with the joy of his coming. She did not mark the strange change in him, but went to him as she had gone to him in the trail, and Jolly Roger's arms closed about her, but gently this time, and very tenderly, as he might have held a little child he was afraid of hurting. Then she felt the chill of his lips as she pressed her own to them. Startled, she looked up into his eyes. And as he had done in the trail, so now Jolly Roger stood her away from him and faced the missioner. In a cold, hard voice, he told what had happened to Nada that evening, and of the barbarous effort Jed Hawkins had made to sell her to Mooney. Then, from a pocket inside his shirt, he drew out a small, flat leather wallet and thrust it in the little missioner's hand. "There's close to $1,000 in that," he said. "It's mine, and I'm giving it to you, for Nada. I want you to keep her and care for her, and maybe some day—" With both her hands, Nada clutched his arm. Her eyes had widened. Swift pallor had driven the color from her face, and a broken cry was in her voice. "I'm going with you," she protested. "I'm going with you, and Peter." "You can't now," he said. "I've got to go alone, Nada. I went back, and I killed Jed Hawkins." Over the roof of the cabin rolled a crash of thunder. As the explosion of it rocked the floor under their feet, Jolly Roger pointed to a door and said, "Father, if you will leave us alone just a minute." White-faced, clutching the wallet, the little gray missioner nodded and went to the door, and as he opened it and entered into the darkness of the other room, he saw Jolly Roger McKay open wide his arms and the girl go into them. After that the storm broke. The rain descended in a deluge upon the cabin roof. The black night was filled with the rumble and roar and the hissing lightning flare of pent-up elements suddenly freed of bondage. And in the darkness and tumult the missioner stood, a little gray man of tragedy, of deeply buried secrets, a man of prayer and of faith in God, his heart whispering for guidance and mercy as he waited. The minutes passed. 5, 10, and then there came a louder roaring of the storm, shut off quickly, and the little missioner knew that a door was opened and closed. He lifted the latch and looked out again into the lamp glow. Huddled at the side of a chair on the floor, her arms and face buried in the lustrous, disheveled mass of her shining hair, lay Nada, and close beside her was Peter. He went to her. Tenderly he knelt down beside her. His thin arm went about her, and as the storm raved and shrieked above them, he tried to comfort her and spoke of God. And through that storm, his head bowed, his heart gone, went Jolly Roger McKay, heading north. End of Chapter 7. Recording by Roger Moline.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs,
plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.